Hello, everybody. Welcome to Rumors, Money, and Movies. 16 months in the making. Finally, we are here. Dune has arrived. It is our Dune podcast. We're joined by Robert, guest of the show. Hasn't been on for a while, though, actually. Good, Bad, and the Ugly. We have Matty G, who hasn't been on since American Graffiti, I believe. Something like that.
Pretty sure.
And then we have Bill. Welcome. So we're here to talk about Dune, and really exciting. First, we're just going to get into our opening reactions. We don't know who liked what, so how about Rob? I know you're very excited. How about you start us off with your opening reactions here?
Yeah, I went to the theater to see it. I saw it the true way to see it, so IMAX, full IMAX 4K. What a way to watch a movie, besides the point. Yeah, I have kind of mixed emotions. I think overall I enjoyed it, but there was definitely aspects I think that we'll get into a little later that I could see that people would not enjoy from it. I thought it was, I overall reading the book, I think it did the book justice. It was a good adaptation, much better than that.
David Lynch, that's Matty G's favorite director. From Matty G.
I watched some scenes from that on YouTube in preparation just to see what the basis point was, and what an upgrade. But yeah, I think I'm gonna have a more comprehensive take once you guys give your opinions, because I'm mixed on it. I liked it, but other aspects of it I thought were somewhat lackluster.
How about Bill, you wanna take a stab at this?
10 out of 10. Loved it.
Really?
Yep.
Oh,
that's all I gotta say.
That's what we like to hear. Opening thoughts, quick and concise. Now, I have a prediction. I mean, we make gambling bets, Matty G and I, whether or not we liked films. I don't think Matty G liked it. I think he disliked it pretty much. That's just my gambler's...
Oh, it wasn't a Marvel movie, right?
Hey, Matty G, speak for yourself, man. Say it with your chest.
Yeah, full disclosure, I did not read the book before watching the movie. I've been looking forward to it for a while. It was not what I expected, but I really enjoyed it. I have some nitpicks, more so about the way I viewed it, which I'll get into more later. My biggest qualm is really just about the ending of the movie, but I don't want to say more than that right now.
Sure. Understandable.
Wow. Okay. I was wrong. This is the way you fade me. You don't tell me. I'm more of like a moderator today because I don't really have any thoughts on this movie. I don't know how to explain it. I watched it Saturday afternoon, big screen, and then somewhat rewatched it for preparation for the show on HBO Max. Got to get those numbers out there for the Warner Brothers clan. But I won't be rewatching it soon, put it that way. But when you have Denis Villeneuve directing something with
Is that the proper pronunciation?
Yeah, Denis. Okay. You're going to have a great or a good film at least, but I was a little somewhat disappointed. I think that was just my expectations were too high for the film. But when you have Denis and you have 9 A-list stars, I thought it was going to be pretty good, and it was. So we'll get into sort of everyone's thoughts, but I just first want to talk about the box office. It finished above expectations. It was projected to make $30 million up until this week. Good preview numbers. It made it up to $40 million. So the HBO Max effect wasn't really in full force, though. Halloween Kills kind of put the streaming aspect a little bit on high alert, but it's very important to see how this film legs out. It finished with $41 million. Halloween Kills tanked. No Time to Die held strong, and so did Venom. But this film opened above expectations, and it also did well simultaneously on HBO Max. It got 1.9 million views in its opening weekend. That's more than Zack Snyder's Justice League, and it's just about the same total as Wonder Woman 1984. It's slightly lower than Space Jam, and also it's only half the size of Mortal Kombat, but it did do better at the box office than Mortal Kombat. So the HBO Max viewership is pretty good, relatively speaking, for the opening. And then you also have the fact that it did pretty good at the box office. So pretty much a win for Warner Brothers. And
what was the budget on this?
$165 million.
Really? That's it?
This movie was $35 million cheaper than Jungle Cruise. I don't know how they were spending money.
That is unbelievable.
Yeah, I don't know how they were spending money. But that's the box office news for this film. Matt, now if you want to read the Rotten Tomatoes blurb, audience score, consensus, etc.
Yeah, so critic score is an 84%. Audience score is a 91%. And then as for the critics' consensus, Dune occasionally struggles with its unwieldy source material, but those issues are largely overshadowed by the scope and ambition of this visually thrilling adaptation. And the audience says, Denis Villeneuve's Dune looks and sounds amazing. And once the admittedly slow building story gets you hooked, you'll be on the edge of your seat for the sequel.
I agree with that.
You seem very energetic to talk, Robert.
I'm very much so.
Now's your time to shine. You and Bill's time to shine here. It's based off a book. Not many people have read the book. It was written in the 1960s. Guys, want to give a basic backdrop on the book and its relevance to the novel. And then I trust, believe us, guys, we're going to get into the what we thought about the movie, but I think it's very important to set up with the book because this is based off a book.
Sure. I read the book over, I think Billy did as well. We read it over the quarantine. And this is, I mean, the book is 630 pages long, right? And it's separated into kind of three parts. This, I think the movie took some aspects of the beginning of part two and cut some things out of part one. If we're going to get into the nitty gritty, I think I would compare this book to almost kind of like a space Bible. I don't know if you want to second that, Billy, just with there's just so much going on and a lot of words to understand and know.
Game of Thrones, space Game of Thrones.
Yeah. Also that as well. I could see that connection with the houses, but really it's, you need to pay attention when reading this, right? It's somewhat similar to the movie. You need to pay attention. You have to live and die and hang on every single word, which could make it a slow read, a slow burn. But overall, I really enjoyed the book. I finished the series, the original series by Frank Herbert, the two other books. But yeah, I really enjoyed the book. It was early in my reading days, so it was a joyful read.
I agree. It's probably one of my favorite books of all time. But what the movie kind of left out was just the scope of the whole universe. It was almost like Frank Herbert created his own languages, he created his own words, he created everything. And the movie kind of just skimmed over that, gave you just the basic plot rather than going diving deep, which you miss with the book.
Yeah, and I think that's just due to the time of the movie. It's hard to fit everything in there. I think like the first 150 pages were not even Dune. It was on the first planet, Caladan. And I actually really enjoyed that segment of the book. In the movie, not so much. And I'm sure we'll get into that. But the opening of the book really sets the stage for the rest of the series. There's a lot of exposition. And you have to pay attention to it. In the movie, I feel like there was exposition, but the exposition was something I had kind of a qualm with.
Okay, so see, we acknowledge the book exists. I was listening to some other podcasts. They're like, we didn't read the book. We don't care. Oh, I'm like, bro, what are you doing? Admit the book exists. It's based off a book. So now that we're out that other way, you guys talked about the exposition. We're going to get to the plot a little bit. Non-spoilers, but it is a very dense. It's a 2 hours and 35 minute movie. It's only half roughly of the first book, right? Half of the first book?
Not even. I'd say a little more than a third.
This is 15 minutes longer than David Lynch's version, and it's half the book, and his was the whole book.
Yeah.
Which is pretty crazy. I know Matt, that's his favorite director. But
what else did David Lynch direct?
Mulholland Drive, a lot of like indie stuff, Twin Peaks. Yeah.
Okay.
But this movie is 2 hours and 35 minutes, and it has an all-star cast starring Timothy Chalamet, Paul Atreides. His father, Leto Atreides, is played by Oscar Isaac. His mother, concubine, Lady Jessica, is played by Rebecca Ferguson. And she is the Beta Gesserit, who's led by Charlotte Rampling. And they're trying to get the world order. Then their assistants are Josh Brolin, played by who plays Gurney Halleck, and Jesse Momoa, who plays Duncan Idaho. Those are the key assistants. And then they're virtually the Harkonnens, led by Stellan Skarsgård and Dave Bautista. And then with all this, on the planet of Dune, you have the Freeman, who's in day is there, but she's in the movie for 5 minutes. Javier Bardem's their leader, who's Stilgard. You also have Sharon Duncan, Leda Kynes, the doctor. She might be Freeman, wink, wink. And then you also have other Freeman that are in the book, in the movie, but also in the book that play a key role. So now we kind of have the lore. It's directed by Denis Villeneuve, who's also directed Blade Runner 2049, Prisoners, Enemy, Arrival. He's one of the auteurs of this current generation. So that's the setup. We got the cast. We got the book. Now let's actually get into the film itself. So it's 2 hours and 35 minutes. we had some problems with the exposition, and I think an outbreak of that is pacing. So, and that kind of goes into the plot. So you guys can take this any way you want. If Matt, you want to start us off since you were had like nitpicky, and then we'll go to the other guys here. But what were your thoughts on the pacing, the plot, rough ideas? You can get specific, but no spoilers.
Yeah. So, I mean, while we're kind of on the topic of the book and the exposition, that's mainly where the area of me being nitpicky came into play. I absolutely regret deciding to read the book after the movie. I think I for sure should have read the book before the movie, because in my mind, that exposition at the beginning of the movie, you know, as someone who wasn't familiar with those words and the terms going into it, I had to like laser focus into that, and I couldn't really just sit back and enjoy and watch the movie. Whereas if I was already familiarized with all those terms, I think I would have been like, all right, I already know what's happening. Now I can just see like, is this a faithful adaptation of the book? And you know, it's very heavy on exposition, which kind of makes you lose interest a little bit. I started reading the book like right after I saw the movie. So before coming on today, I watched up to what I had read on HBO Max, and I definitely enjoyed it more after having read the book.
This guy's grinding over here, reading, rewatching. Mega fan in the making.
So to go off that point of kind of this exposition, I thought it was, again, being someone who's read the book, I thought it was tasteful in the sense it wasn't just blurting a bunch of kind of background, like the 10,000 year background of this whole universe. It intermingled it into conversation. Yeah, you had scenes where it was either a narrator or projector kind of scenes where they were giving you information and you had to take it in. But for specifics about characters and their motives and how they come about, I feel like it was more woven into conversation. So that aspect, I personally enjoyed of it. It wasn't just 10,000 years ago in this faraway galaxy, so-and-so, Paul Atreides lives on Caladan sort of thing. So I thought that aspect of it was a more tasteful exposition.
All right, passive aggressive towards Star Wars right there. That's fine. How about you, Bill?
Yeah, so like I can't unread the book, you know. So I can't untangle my kind of excitement in the first at least half of the movie. A lot of that was me like, ooh, how are they gonna portray Gurney? Or like, ooh.
Yeah.
Oh, they did a good job casting, I don't know, Duncan, something like that. And I wasn't really focused on what the viewer who had no background knowledge whatsoever might be thinking. So I can't really answer the question of how the exposition of the plot was laid out there.
You had some troubles with the casting when it first was released, right, Billy? Which one did you like?
Still, I still don't like it at all. Idaho, to me, I pictured him as a black dude. The whole time. And then Gurney definitely should have been like a redhead Irish dude.
I like the Gurney.
I don't know. I really feel like he needed to be more Irish, more red haired.
The one character they did change from the book was the Lieutenant Kynes, like the ecologist. Uh-huh. That in the book was a male character. And in the film, obviously, was a female character. It didn't really change the storytelling or plot at all, but that was just one minor switch I think the director made.
Was he actually a male in the book? Is that confirmed?
Yeah,
I feel like when I was reading it there were points where I was like, wait, I can't tell. And now, and when I watched it, it didn't even like register to me that, oh, that's definitely wrong. Yeah, it was like vague, like, wait, did they screw that up?
Mm-hmm.
Also, you guys are talking about, I mean, this cast is absolutely stacked. Out of the people I named, you also have Chang Chen, David Damakian. I mean, you have like 15 people who are in this film. And that's kind of the difficult part about the exposition. I mean, for me, I didn't really mind it. I thought it was as good as it could have been. Though this film is like kind of bad at the same time, just because it's somewhat poorly written. At least in my opinion, I understand the source material, you have to kind of write some stuff that isn't so good. But I thought it was...
What parts of it were poorly written?
The expositions at times were somewhat forced. I feel as if they're trying to do too much. They're setting up for the future a lot. There's a lot to get in. it's sometimes like forced. You're trying to get too much done. And also, I can't help but we're talking about exposition and plot. And it's not the movie's fault, but everything in this movie is cliche at this point. No disrespect to Frank Herbert. You can disagree with that. But, you know, every main plot trope and point is like, it's been copied so many times. So something that was created the science fiction genre now seems a little dated, which is one of the big questions.
But this was the original science fiction. So everything was either took its tropes from this because, but I see what you're saying in terms of the movie aspect. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was just my issue with the plot. There's also a lot of terms that I think what Matt was saying, you had Lizana Gaib, you had Karat Hasdari, you had Darez, you had Ben Gesserit. I mean, obviously it's Middle Eastern flair, which we'll talk about when we get to the themes, but so Lizana Gaib was Messiah and Ben Gesserit were like these shadow nuns, but what was Kawait Hardarez? Was I supposed to know what that was?
You want to take this one, Bill?
How do you spell that? I don't know.
It's the Kizarak Hadaris.
Kwisatz Haderach?
Yes. Kwisatz Haderach.
Yeah, they did an absolute horrible job, like even explaining. I can't remember if Herbert explained what it was when Paul did that hand thing, but it is the Ben Gesserit. They try to control the genes of like all the major families that the whole movie revolves around and all the different branches. And they do that by having all of their members who are women. They're all women, all their members. They all choose to have girl children, which I guess you can do in the future. And then they marry them off to different families, like the Atreides or like the Harkonnens or whatever. And then they do the same thing. They have female children. They marry them off and they intertwine and stuff. And then there's like supposed to be a chosen one who learns the Ben Gesserit ways, who is a male, which gives them some sort of added power onto the like Ben Gesserit stuff. They already have like that voice that you guys saw throughout the movie.
I thought that was really well done, actually.
Yeah, it was. There's that. There's the like trances and like the visions of the future. That's
if I was to relate it to something, it would be like the Jedi or the Force in Star Wars, right? They're kind of like they have powers that others can't possess. I'm gonna actually. I have the appendix open for the book. I'll read the definition of a Kwisatz Haderach. So. It's shortening of the way. This is the label applied by the Bene Gesserit to the unknown for which they sought a genetic solution, a male Bene Gesserit whose organic mental powers would bridge space and time. So essentially, building off what Billy was saying, it's supposed to be kind of like this all-powerful being that's supposed to take the universe and push it forward into a better, more unified sphere.
Yeah, that was like handpicked and puppet mastered through genes, like through genes and like so many generations that this one person was supposed to end up in that place in that time and be a male.
One thing I want to say about that is that I feel like the Bene Gesserit was really like the tone of the film, set the tone for the film. Then he did like a really cool stuff with like L cuts and J cuts. That's when you make the sound and the screen not match up. So when someone would be like, give me your glass, you'd be like, would like zoom in time and be reversed.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of sets the whole play in motion. And obviously when it's talked about stories, but they really set the whole book into motion, but also I think they set the tone of the story. And that's really where the lighting comes in. The lighting in this film is really very much based off the tone. So you have yellow lighting. You also have like blue lighting on Caladan, which is the home planet of Atreides. You then have this dark lighting, this black lighting. And then it's very much sort of a lot of artificial light. I mean, it's not CGI though. It's all practical, but it's really, you have like really dark lighting on top of light lighting with bombs and droids and all this other interesting stuff. I mean, did the tone play well for you guys as well, especially guys who read the novel? And Matt, you can comment. This is like the tone is everything. Was it too dark? Was it not dark? Was it fun? Was it engaging? Was it just right? I mean, I personally like the tone, but I'm wondering what you guys think. And I think that goes hand in hand with the plot, for me at least.
Matty G, you want to start?
Yeah, so kind of was based off the trailers and what I'd heard about this, I was anticipating this movie to be kind of the next Star Wars Lord of the Rings franchise, big fantasy epic with likable characters and kind of just an enjoyable ride throughout. That wasn't really the tone in my mind. I think everyone was very straight-faced throughout the whole movie. Like, the characters didn't really ooze personality or charisma. And that's kind of also part of why I wish I read the book first. I think that wasn't what I anticipated going into it. Not that I dislike what we got, it's just I didn't expect it. So everything was monotone to an extent, and it was very, very much more focused on the politics of it than being like a blockbuster film, which the trailers sort of made it out to be at points. So I guess I was a little put off by it, but I didn't dislike it. Like, I liked the tone, but it wasn't what I expected.
Yeah, I agree with that sentiment that it felt kind of monotone at times. But again, being somebody who read the book before, I think all the players in the book are very calculated, and in the film as well, they're very educated about what they're doing. So there's no quote unquote BS or kind of faking it, in terms of they have to be kind of the straight-laced things, especially in this section of the story, just because it is a very serious time and there's no time for fun and games. Even like straight from the jump, I feel like everybody was on edge already, and they had to be kind of educated and kind of plotting their next move, because any step could lead to their demise, right? So that's I could see how it's different from other blockbusters. There wasn't like this happy-go-lucky character. There wasn't a lot of, I think there was, I counted like 2 jokes in the whole film, but overall, I like the tone. I like the, you could definitely tell the contrast between the Atreides and the Harkonnens. And I think that was due to Denis Villeneuve, kind of the, how James was talking about the lighting. I feel that set the tone as well as the soundtrack. I thought the music score was really nice as well.
By Hans Zimmer,
classic, passed up on Tenet to do this film.
Very good. How about you, Bill?
Yeah, going back to what Matt said about the characters and their personality, I'll give an example, just one example of how it can affect it. But so Paul in the book, he's 12 or something like that. And like when you're reading it and you see him commanding people like Duncan Idaho, you're like, you don't think twice about it. But when you see it in real life and you see like skinny little Timothée Chalamet trying to fill that role, it just doesn't click the same way as it does when you're reading it, when you can kind of put that to the back of your mind. But I think it's hard to be a super charismatic, crazy leader guy when you're Timothée Chalamet and you just have like a bunch of grown men that you're pretending to boss around. I think it kind of makes him more reserved.
Well, the last thing we'll get into, we talked kind of about the lighting. I wanted to bring up the lighting and the tone. I thought the tone was fine, but we'll get into the casting now. For me, at least, I thought there's a lot of talk about Rebecca Ferguson. Very raspy. And she talks very much like British in the film. And I kind of find that funny because everyone talks like differently.
Yeah.
And like Timothée Chalamet sounds like he's like a New York. He sounds like he's a Timothée Chalamet for the first 20 minutes. And Gurney's like talking a certain way. But I thought the cast was very good. Obviously, Stellan Skarsgård's character, Baron, is clearly, there's a visual too. Exactly like Marlon Brando in Apocalypse Now. I mean, that's the thing they were going for 100%. It's clear as day. You don't make it that obvious if it's not for a reason. But I also thought that, I mean, a lot of the characters like Zendaya, Javier Bardem, they're not really in it for a long time, so it's not really anything to really get into. But I thought Oscar Isaac was very reserved. And I mean, he's very talented. I've seen him in other films, but you know, when you get an actual director that knows what they're doing, it's kind of surprising how you can like actors more. Also like Rebecca Ferguson, I know I made fun of her, but I didn't really think she was that talented, but she was really good in this film, really good.
She was good. Oscar Isaac, I thought, building off that tone comment, I thought he didn't have a lot to work off of based on the script, but you could tell that he was trying to be that charismatic leader and somebody who could carry the film in that direction. I just don't think he had a lot to work with based on the on his script or his role in the film, because he wasn't really the main character per se.
Yeah. I mean, the main character is like Paul is Timothy, but I also think the main character you could argue is kind of like Lady Jessica too.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously she's very relevant to the rest of the story. I don't know if you guys want to chime in, Bill or Matt, you didn't like certain actors, you weren't caught your eye or.
Yeah. I didn't realize that there was like a controversy over Rebecca Ferguson. I thought she was.
No. I don't mean controversy. I mean, she got like a lot of praise, I'm trying to say.
Oh,
I
don't know. Okay.
Everyone's
okay,
saying cool. She did so great.
I thought she was, thought she was the best character in the movie. I thought she had the best performance. I think she had the most interesting things to do throughout the movie. And then I totally agree with Rob's point about Leto kind of trying to break through a little bit and add a little bit more character into the film. And I think people also seem to like Duncan Idaho. And I think the reason is because he has the one joke in the movie. So you give the guy one joke when nobody else has a joke, and obviously he's going to seem like the most charismatic.
Josh Brolin has jokes. He's funny. Josh Brolin has a couple one-liners. Barney.
Does he?
100%.
I can't recall the one-liners, but 100%. They were probably there.
Gurney was like the most straight-faced character. I feel like maybe characters interacting with him had like smile Gurney thing.
Pulling back the curtain, Gurney was my favorite character in the book. I think it was one of Billy's top characters too. So I thought it was a good portrayal. I liked him. But again, it goes back to kind of the situation the characters are in. Gurney was a head swordsman. And he's a director of the army, so he didn't have any times to fit in jokes because they were going switching planets and he had a lot of other serious things on his mind. So I think for his character standpoint, it wasn't a time to joke around.
But I think he did a nice job, at least. I mean, you can continue, Matt, if you had anything else.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying that he had to be making jokes running around. I don't think he did. but I mean, even in the like one chapter I've read with Gurney in it, in the book, I feel like, I mean, you guys obviously read the whole thing, so you're way more versed than I am, but there are kind of subtleties that I didn't pick up on having viewed it as a movie for the first time. Like when Gurney and Paul are meeting for the first time in that kind of training room, and Paul says like, sing us a song instead. You know, I thought that was like him taking a jab at Gurney. I didn't realize that Gurney is actually like a poet and a musician as well, whereas in the book he's like actually an artist in addition to a soldier, which really adds to his character, I feel like.
Well, okay, that's interesting. That's why you gotta read the books.
Yeah, no, they could have made that more clear. That definitely came out of left field if you were seeing the movie going in blind, right?
They literally put like,
that might have been some fan service.
The one aspect they referenced that was the sketchy looking guitar thing on Gurney's bed when she was hitting the fan. They like, you could see it for like a split second, and like if you knew what you were looking for, you're like, okay, there it is. But other than that, they made no reference to him ever playing the lyre or whatever it was and singing songs.
The lyre.
Yeah.
Oh, that was good.
Well, I mean, you said you had some issues with the casting first, but were they good ones you saw?
Yeah, mostly my issues were with the kind of like appearances. Like I was completely picturing something else, and like you just see it and you're like, yeah.
But then what did you think of the Freeman?
How they were the Freeman. They were fine. That's kind of what I expected. Mm-hmm. Besides the fact that Stilgar had like an Eastern European accent out of nowhere. There's no reason for that. I didn't get that. Same with Bass the Younger was saying
Jameis.
Yeah. Bass the Younger was talking about Lady Jessica and her like funky accent, and then you have Paul, but Timothy Chalamet, who was kind of talking, I thought he was talking not really slang like, but not as formal as a Duke's son.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
talking like regular.
Yeah, that kind of, I was like, wait, what? But and then also, like, come on, you had to cast Batista, shaved, no eyebrows, like that is so cliche for like an ugly bad guy. I feel like he's played that role in like what, three other movies. Like, why couldn't they have chosen somebody?
Is that how he was depicted in the book, Rabian, or like any of the Harkonnens? Because they're all bald. I didn't pick up on that reading.
No, I didn't get that either from the book. But like, I mean, they could have made somebody bald, but like Batista, it's been done before.
Hey, don't bam at my wrestlers over here. Come on now. I walk alone, baby. I walk alone. No. But we properly set up the book, the movie. We kind of, it's very confusing, obviously. So if you're confused right now, take a time out, go on Wikipedia, look at the cast.
Yeah, should we outline the plot or the general?
I thought I did kind of
idea earlier of the movie,
but I'll do it right now too. Yeah. I mean, you want to do it? I mean, I kind of did it earlier, but if you want to say it, you can. I mean, now we spoilers. So if you see, if you've listened now, you've seen it.
Yeah. So essentially, this movie is setting up the universe of Dune, right? And it's like Billy was saying, it's kind of Game of Thrones, this bunch of different houses. So this movie in particular is about setting up how House Atreides came to Dune and setting up shop on Dune and how they were put into a trap, right? So that's, and how they faced that. So that's kind of the most general version of the plot. Did I miss anything?
No, and the reason why they were put into a trap is because of Paul's potential to maybe be the Lisan al Gaib, right?
The Mahadib.
The Mahadib. Yeah, why they use two terms for that, by the way?
He's basically everything in the, or they say he's everything in the universe, right? And any cool name.
I don't know what you guys are saying. Like
the Lazada Gimp?
Like, I don't know what you're saying.
The,
like,
the mob, the like, Mahadib.
Mahadib. M-U-A-D dash D, Mahadib. So the Mahadib is field mouse in the language. So those mice that you guys saw running around.
Oh,
that was so. Yeah.
But isn't it also like the, isn't it also the Freeman like God or the prophet?
Yeah. The Freeman prophet. In the legend. Yeah. Mahadib is the one that will be coming to them to save them. And it stands, it's like, it means field mouse. And then
so those mouse weren't just to sell some toys.
No,
it was a little drop.
Uh-huh. Cool. Yeah. So, okay. So I think we got it set. The reason I wanted him dead, because he could be like the prophet. And that's because the emperor with the army that he sent, they knew.
Yeah.
So now we have it sufficiently set up. I have some thoughts about the middle hour and the pacing at the end, but if you guys want to take it anywhere, any direction you guys want now, open floor, spoilers, you can say really whatever you want about the film at this point, plot-wise, and what you thought was good, was not good, what went right, what went wrong.
Okay, I'll air my biggest grievance, which was...
Let it fly.
I'm letting it fly. The very end of the movie and that fight scene that kind of capped off the movie, absolutely butchered that.
The so-called climax.
Yeah, they... So let me ask you guys that didn't watch the movie, what did you guys think was going on when Paul was toying with him? When he was just putting the knife to his neck?
He asked him to, like, forgiveness. He asked him to yield, right? Like, forfeit or whatever.
And so what they made it sound like in the movie was, oh, Paul's never killed a man before. So that was part of it in the book. Another big part that they kind of didn't explain in the movie, which I think would have been cool, was the fact that Paul's never fought somebody without a shield on, and that when you need to fight somebody with a shield on, you need to slow your blade down at the very last second in order for it to pierce the shield, and then you can finish it off so you can get skin and kill him. So when he was in the book, initially he was getting his ass kicked because he was getting close and then not being able to finish the blow because he had never fought somebody without a shield on, and they completely skipped over that and just said, oh, Paul's never killed a man.
Yeah, they definitely did Jameis. They did Jameis dirty there. Completely. That was actually one of the best. That was like one of the best fight scenes in the book.
Yeah, and then they did three quick jabs and then killed him.
Yeah,
and then that was supposed to be the
so-called climax.
At the end of that, another thing that completely was horrible was the fact that they skipped over the part in the book where Paul cried over Jameis's body, and everybody around was like, he gives his water for the dead, and which you guys know, like, water is sacred over there. So when you cry to somebody that you killed, it's like, what are you doing, idiot? Like, save your water.
Yeah.
And that I feel like that gave a real, like, human aspect to Paul when you're thinking about his character and everybody around him, like his mother and Chani too, definitely took note of that, which they completely skipped over. And I feel like that was a big part of the plot.
Yeah. That's building off that point. Not, I guess we're starting at the end, but that part of the story was actually in part two, in book one.
Well, on your point, you said that the climax didn't really work for you, Bill. That was like the climax of the story. Well, and that's because they ended the book halfway through and there wasn't really a clear ending point. But I guess thematically, maybe it's Paul becoming a leader, becoming a man. I know what Denis was trying to do. But, I mean, interesting off the point, the real climax of this movie, separated from the book, was really the siege of Arkane. Pronunciation, I apologize. That's the real climax of the film, and that was my personal favorite part. It was like 20 minutes, the portrayal from Dr. Yoon, you have the death of Leto, you have really just like this, you have to run away, you have to leave. Now, it's been done since then. It reminded me kind of like Gladiator a little bit, actually, low-key. Remember me of like that, but also like other films as well, like they have to like run away from the siege when the bad guys come in. But I thought it was beautifully filmed. The lighting was fantastic, the way it was shot, the sort of explosions and like being in the center and being symmetrical. The lighting was fantastic.
Very cool visuals, right, during that siege for sure.
But that was the climax. And your points, you said, Bill, you were like the climax of the story was like at the end, but it really wasn't the climax. That was, for me at least, the pacing was a problem in the second half, because you had this climax in the middle, like an hour and a half in, 20 minutes long, and then you have 45 minutes of them just kind of having to go through the desert to get to this like other climax of them linking up with the Fremen. I don't know if that's kind of what you're going at, but at least for me, that was the problem with the second half.
That makes total sense. Yeah. I there was definitely flat parts in the film, but as well as the book, but I think the major climax is, I think, besides the ending, I think that was underwhelming. I think the battle scene with Duncan Idaho was awesome. That was really well done. Also in the middle, when they saved kind of that rescue mission, I thought that was a good, exciting moment.
That was the best scene in the movie.
Yeah. I actually had one question, Bill. In the book, I felt like people on the rescue mission, I don't think everybody survived. Right? I thought people died. And
so remember, there was the people that ran away on their own, who we found out later, who were Fremen.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't know that the Fremen were working the mines or whatever. But right. I think they saved all the Atreides guys. And that was another thing. Like, they kind of skipped over how Leet Kynes was so shocked that Leto was so concerned about saving his men when there was like billions of dollars worth of spice on that cargo ship that they just dropped so that they could save the men.
Yeah, which that's again, just because adds, they're used to Harkonnens, right?
Yeah, they're used to Harkonnens, but it adds character to Leto that you don't get if you don't look at or think about it. That it could have been mentioned and made Leto look like a better character, I think.
Yeah, that's what I was referring to when I said he had some good characterization. You could see that it was peeking through.
Oh, yeah, and back to what Matt was saying, like when I gave that example about the not having the best character personalities and stuff, a lot of it's hard because like the two of the main guys died. The one guy's a little baby boy who's leading men around, but yeah, like Leto and Duncan, Leto only got like half screen time, right? Like he died pretty early.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I would have liked to see more of them, but.
What did you guys think of the Duke's death scene? Did you like that scene? Was it well done?
It was well shot. But go ahead, Matt.
I think it was okay. I wasn't overly fond of it because I'm not saying how it was shot well, but I'm saying the death itself in that, and again, this is based off a book, obviously, so it's not really the film's fault, but I feel like his death served no purpose in that he was given this thing to kill the Baron. And then he just doesn't kill the Baron. So he kind of just kills himself for no reason particularly, I guess, other than to provide narrative motivation to Paul and Jessica to get revenge on the Harkonnens.
Yeah. And actually in the book, I feel like they had some back and forth. It wasn't just like the Duke like murmuring to himself or like trying to get words out. They actually had some sort of back and forth. And I'm not sure why they would have cut that off. That would have been good characterization for the two heads of the two houses to have some dialogue. I thought that was a missed opportunity. But I guess the sentiment of not killing the Baron doesn't make a whole lot of sense in terms of it was kind of like a pointless nothing. But he did kill a lot of top leaders in the Harkonnens and it did set them back. They killed Peter DeFries, the top Mentat. So it definitely served more of a purpose than just to kill the Baron. It was kind of harming everyone involved, right?
There's also the fact that who knows what they would have done to him if he didn't have the opportunity to kill himself. It's like they could have like tortured him horrifically. I mean, it's year like what, 10,000 AD at that point. They probably got some freaky stuff going.
Yeah.
And I mean, they could have like, I don't know.
And he was naked for some reason. Yeah, I don't like remember
they could have completely defaced him, but he got to kill himself, which I think in one light is good.
That makes sense. I have a feeling though that whole scene probably works better in the scope of like the entire, once all the movies are released, it'll probably work better. Whereas in this movie, it didn't work so well for me because also then you have the Baron live, and this is part of why I kind of had a problem with the climax. And the Harkonnens are the rivals to the Atreides throughout the whole film. And then in the climax, you have nothing to do with that. And Paul is fighting against a character that we're just introduced to. And I get that the point was to show Paul overcoming things and like having to mature through killing him. But that was also established as the fight scene was taking place that Paul had never killed anybody. And I know that wasn't, it was more about the shield, like you said in the book. But I feel like if they wanted to convey that in the climax, they should have either established the shield thing you were discussing or that he'd never killed someone previously earlier on in the movie. And then that would give it more impact later on, rather than saying, Paul's never killed anybody, now watch him kill someone. It's like you have less time to feel like that has weight to it. So it didn't really work in my mind.
Yeah, that I agree with that sentiment that, again, the ending was underwhelming. He had to overcome the fear of not only killing someone, but now he's on his own. He's the supposed Duke, but he's the Duke of nothing, right? It's just him and his mom left for all that they know. And that's why I actually think, after hearing what Matt said, that this was actually a great stopping point in the story, because we're kind of left off. Paul and Lady Jessica are joining the Freemen. That's a new adventure for them. They have to become accustomed to their culture and learn. And the Baron was just survived an attack, so he's got to reshuffle his plans. So everybody's kind of left in this no man's land. I guess Paul and Lady Jessica are actually in like a no man's land because they're in the middle of the desert. But at the end of the film, everybody's kind of left shuffling around at the events of the siege.
We'll get to that a little bit later when we talk about the sequel and whatnot. But I do want to say that leading up to when they meet the Fremen, that I want to quote, I get a quote from every movie. And my quote is from actually Jameis. Shout out to Jameis. The mystery of life isn't a problem to solve, but a reality to experience, a process that cannot be understood by stopping it. We must move with the flow of the process. We must join it. We must flow with it. That was my quote from this film. And that was from Jameis, who died at the
Jameis end. Said that?
Yes, sir. Wow. In the middle of the scene when he was like communicating, he was like, let go, don't try to control the plane in the dust storm. But the lighting again was really cool in that scene because of the yellowness. And I will say one more thing about this sort of costuming that I enjoyed about the film, because I didn't really enjoy the plot, was even when they were in the desert, they all got freckles. Like they would change the makeup based off the setting. Like on Caladan, everyone looked more blue. Like it was physically like it was more blue lighting. And then like even like Rebecca Ferguson's eyes were like really blue, but they weren't like Fremen blue. They were like just drawn. Everyone's face was drawn out from the blue. But then on like Arrakis, they really made a change. So like everyone's face was way more dull and freckly. And it was just cool. I appreciated it more from like I think it's going to get nominated for a couple of Oscars and stuff. Not that matters, but that sort of thing I appreciated more than the slow plot at the end, because I think it was pretty anticlimactic, as you guys were saying.
Mm-hmm.
Back to the costume in there. When they, so the eyes of all the Fremen, so they did like the blue contacts, and then like I don't know how they got the whites of their eyes to like be like light blue, but that's not how I was picturing it. You guys ever watched Naruto?
No.
No,
we don't watch
it. No, just wrestling.
People watch people watch anime though.
The viewers will.
So there's a Rinnegan is what they call it. It's like it's an eye with like a bunch of different rings outside of it. So I was picturing that with like different layers of blue. So when I saw like just like the blue contacts, then like the blue eye white, I was like,
Yeah, the eyes cool. Were there was also, let's jump into that aspect of the film. The dream sequences, whether it was the voices or the voice or the shield. I think they did a really good, or the spice in the sand, even like that first shot when Zendaya was talking about on my planet is most beautiful when the sun is down and you could see the spice in the air. And it was kind of the shiny specks were supposed to be the spice. I thought that was really creative and a really good way of visual storytelling, excuse me. One other aspect of the filmmaking, there were so many great shots, cinematography shots in this movie. Again, going back to the lighting, like James was saying, I just wanted to touch on one scene. Remember, this was one, right before Duncan dies and he kills all those cars, when they're like floating down and it's all black around them and the floor is the only thing lighting, and then you just see them drop from the sky. That was, quite honestly, I thought that was the best shot scene in the film. So
it was cool. They put the little shot glass that all the Fremen were drinking out of, put it on the ground in the scene you're talking about. You know what I'm, you know?
Yes. Yeah. And then they started running.
Yeah. They skedaddled. I thought that was neat.
Very cool. But yeah, what were you guys' thoughts on these dream sequences? Were they confusing, hard to follow? Because sometimes even in the book, it was, you didn't really fully understand what was going on. It's almost like the dreams are spoilers within the movie. So I was wondering your thoughts on that.
I have some bad thoughts about this. So someone else, Matt, you want to talk? Or you've been silent, too silent today, Matt.
Sorry. No, I think that's a great way of describing it. Spoilers for the movie, like within the movie. I didn't find them to be confusing particularly because I kind of got what was going on with the whole dream thing. But I think there were definitely some sequences in the dreams that weren't in the movie. Maybe I'm wrong about that. And that left me a little bit confused. I guess they're going to be in the sequel or a third installment. I don't know how many they're making, probably three. And then I would say,
wait, you're half under, bro. They're making like six.
I think it's going to be closer to five or six. Yeah.
For like the whole Dune series or just the first book?
Well, there's five books and they made the first one into two. They're probably going to make six.
Well, I think they're just going to follow the first three books. Honestly, I think that's a comprehensive trilogy.
Okay.
Yeah. I would say the more confusing aspect of it was that Shani, I don't know how to pronounce her name, was like so heavily focused on. And then, as we mentioned earlier, she was in the movie for a total of about 5 minutes as an actual character. So it really like played her up as being this super significant character. And I'm sure she will be, but she wasn't in this movie, at least in my mind.
I don't understand why they would play her up. I didn't do any of the advertising or whatever. But back to the dream, or not the dream, the spoiler inside the movie, the dreams. So I thought they did a really good job of depicting what, because that's kind of a like momentous scene in the book when he first gets that taste of spice and what that does, which they don't explain well, is it allows you to see into the future. And what he's seeing in those two visions of, one was piles of bodies burning, the other was an army who waves the Atreides flag on like a holy war. And he's seeing both of those. And so in the book, it goes through like the whole conflict that he's feeling, that he needs to choose like between these paths in the future that he's seeing. It's neither of them a good path, and they don't do that justice. They kind of just flash that. I don't even know if you guys remember it because it's completely skipped over.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, those bodies burning and then the flags being waved on that battle.
Was that when they had that bad CGI of him kind of fighting the Sadukan?
Yes.
In that war. Yes. And then like his face shield went out like a superhero. That scene I didn't really care for too much. But I agree with you, Billy, that they did a bad job introducing the spice and how it affects Paul. Because that's like that's what makes him have these lucid, vivid dreams, right? Because he was only having them on Caladan when he was actually asleep. But then when he gets to Arrakis Dune, he could have it while he's awake. And that's vital into what could potentially make him the Mahadib or the Kizarat Hadarak, whatever you want to say, the chosen one. And that's a major point that I think was more glossed over, how important the spice is, right?
Yeah, I didn't pick up on that at all. I thought that his visions were kind of like a Bene Gesserit power of some kind that was passed on to him. So for me, that was not clear whatsoever that that was like brought about by the spice. And I wish they kind of established that more clearly.
Yeah, I kind of got it because he said, I mean, the seeds were planted in the worm scene, the first worm scene, and then were brought out in that second scene. I didn't really like the scene because it was kind of cringe just because it was like a lot of exposition. But when you have great actors and a great director, it's kind of forgivable. I don't like it because it's super, it gives away like the whole movie. And it kind of reminds me of like a, and this is like the sins of this film coming back because it's almost like breaks every rule of like what a movie shouldn't do. Too much exposition, building for a sequel that, you know, focus on the movie that you have. It like breaks every single rule and yet everyone is talking about it. It like breaks it in the right way. I mean, they don't say jihad, which I think is interesting because in the book it's like jihad, 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 jihad. Now they're going to say holy war. And I want to transition. I think there's a good point to transition in because you have all this stuff in the 60s. It's book written in the 60s, but it might be even more relevant today. And we're talking about, you know, jihad. Clearly, Iraq is his metaphor for the Middle East. Spice is like an all-powerful drug for some people, but it's also used for intergalactic travel. So it's like maybe oil.
You can tweak in off that spice, huh?
Yes. Yeah. So it's like an all-knowing drug as well. So what did you guys think of the themes of the book? I know the themes of the book, obviously only halfway through the first book, and the themes of the film are different, but clearly there's a metaphor for this film that we're talking about. And there's a lot that goes into that because obviously you have like, is it like the white savior? Because Paul's like saving all these, you know, these like quote unquote Middle Eastern, no one's Middle Eastern in the movie, but you get kind of what I'm saying. Like
outcasts,
the Oriental.
Outcasts so, of the.
The white guy is like the Messiah for the Oriental. It's kind of like biblical Moses. I got kind of that sense. We'll take you to paradise. What do you guys think of the religious implications, the socioeconomic implications, political implications, good, bad, meaningful, not meaningful? What'd you take away? Have at it.
Yeah, I guess I'll touch on this. Reading the book, I think I mentioned this earlier, definitely reads like Frank Herbert was writing a space Bible, right? It's the outlines of this kind of this person, Paul. It could be Jesus, somebody who kind of transforms and tries to bring society into, or the universe into this greater kind of place. I didn't really see the, what you were touching on, kind of him leading these outcasts or whatever you want to refer to it as into the
Orientals
into this kind of holy destination. I didn't see it in that way. If Bill, you want to touch on this?
For me, I completely ignore that kind of stuff when I'm reading a book, and I focus on the story that's being told in the now, I guess, and like what's actually going on. Cause I mean, you can attribute stuff to anybody's writing, and if the shoe fits, maybe you can get away with making that argument. So I try not to do that, and I just enjoyed the story that was being told, which was fantastic, and some of the ideas too inside it. So what I was going at with the, you know, he sees the piles of bodies burning, or he sees everybody waving the Atreides flag, and when you think about that idea as how we live our lives, it's kind of funky to think about that. That's kind of how we live our lives. We see a future and maybe we see another future, and you make the choices that you try to kind of follow that path, set the dominoes going down that path towards the future that you want. And that's basically what he's doing in this whole movie, is he's trying to get to a future that he's seen, but is the right future. And he's trying to throw out the millions of other futures that he sees that are shit.
Yeah, but it's relevant. I mean, I'm not trying to call you out here, but I think if it's in the story, it's there for a reason. So, I mean, I understand.
About the jihad stuff? About
anything. All that stuff. Yeah, I mean, any story. If you're going to bring, I mean, it's clearly there. I mean,
but it's speculation.
It is speculation, though. I'll tell you what, I didn't see that in reading the book or watching the movie. This was a thought that I, for the first time, I guess it makes sense when you put it in the words that you're saying, but going off Billy's point, I think it's more about the story and the characters itself. Than I don't think Frank Herbert or Denis Villeneuve is trying to kind of perpetuate that. I think they're just trying to tell the story, right?
I mean, it wouldn't be there though.
I mean, it's in the book though.
But you're not going to say, you're not going to have a spice and all knowing good on a planet that you, why would you put it in there? You're not just putting it in there just to have a cool story. If you're Frank Herbert.
I haven't read the book in full, so you guys know more probably, but I'm with James here. I for sure see the oil parallel. Like, I think there's a lot of legitimacy to that. And I mean, the religious stuff, I don't know about as much, but I think at the very least the comparison between the spice and oil is like certainly where the story was coming from.
Yeah, and I don't think me and Billy are saying that the comparisons aren't there. But we're saying it was more, but it could be speculated that it was used as inspiration. But we were just speaking on the fact that we don't see that as the whole main plot of the story or the theme of the story, right? Is that what you're going for?
Yeah, yeah. What I'm like, definitely you can see the parallels and you can talk about like whatever you want, seeing the parallels. But to say that Frank Herbert wrote this talking about or trying to like shed light on a certain social issue is kind of overstepping the boundary is what I'm getting at.
Yeah. Especially this book again was written in the 1960s. We don't know.
And if he never commented on what he meant when he was doing it, you can't really attribute anything afterward. I mean, you can speculate, but you can't take it as gospel.
Well, when I watched, that's what I got. I think colonialism and stuff. I'm not saying Frank Herbert had a specific like goal in mind, but
no, that the colonialism aspect is definitely there because the Harkonnens, even the Barons, kill them all when he's talking to Rabian and we're trying to squeeze profits. So the parallels are definitely there to kind of like we're in this place, we're colonizing them, we're taking all their product and goods, and we're not sharing any of the benefit. So the parallels most definitely there.
I mean, and you can make another parallel to, what is it, the French Indian War, and you could say the Fremen are the Indians, and you got the French and the British, the Harkonnens and the Atreides trying to leverage the Native Americans fighting prowess against one another.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I mean, you can say whatever you want and you can see whatever you want, but nothing's truth, I guess.
This might be stepping back a second, but you just mentioned the Harkonnens, Rob, so I had a quick question. Is Fade a significant character? Because I don't think he was in this movie. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Is he important?
That's the nephew, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure Billy was going to want to touch on this at some point. That was something that I wrote down in my notes that was missing from this film. He's a huge player in the book. He's kind of the parallel to Paul he's the Harkonnen Paul, right? So he's what they suspect to be kind of this great, powerful future leader. So he's a big player. I hope he's in the second or part two, because that's a great storyline. He's a huge player. Touching on things that they're missing in the book about the Harkonnens, there was a storyline. I wanted to bring this up earlier, but Billy knows exactly where I'm going. The Baron is gay, and they don't touch on that in the movie. And I think that would have added some sort of aspect to the Harkonnens that would have made them either more likable. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think that's like part of when Herbert wrote this, you could have the Baron taking young boys to bed.
Yeah, like he could be this evil being.
And then readers are like, oh, disgusting. But like you do that in 2021, and then it's like there's a whole different perspective. It's
speculation.
Like,
speculation.
Well, I think they might have cut that out. That's a cliche in old Roman films. You make the villain like old Roman classic films. It's just kind of like an opera in a sense of epic. You make the villain gay in a sense. He's not actually gay, but he has gay qualities, feminine qualities. And you associate him against the main bravado man. They might have did that just to modernize it, because it's like a cliche in old. If you see a lot of old Roman films, the villains usually has some sort of gay tendency, feminine tendency. But I mean, you guys touched on like the fact that the nephew isn't there. And looking forward, heading out of Dune Part 2, obviously there's the whole like jihad section, which I didn't really like. We were all kind of like lukewarm on it. It was kind of cringe for me. But obviously Jessica's pregnant. that might be a big deal, it seems, wink, wink, in the next book, or at least the next couple.
I'm very curious how they touch on that whole situation.
Right. Well, that's more in book two and stuff. Well, that's So we got to see how many more sequels are going to give this puppy, but they have the other guy. You said it's like other the nephew.
Yeah.
I mean, you said there's still a sizable portion of Dune to go in this story, right? There's still like a lot left to be told. You guys have read the book.
Oh yeah. There's definitely, and I think I know Denny had a kind of interview today saying this film was, again, I know James doesn't like this term, but it was setting up the world. Right. And I think it did a good job setting up the world. And I think the next movie, they're going to let it fly and shoot from the hip. I think we're going to see an action classic, and it's going to build off this one and be more exciting. There's definitely the material there for it.
You guys, everyone's excited? 2 years from now, it's announced.
I mean, I love this one.
Hell yeah.
So.
You love it 100%. Rob and Matt, you guys seem to be on the same level of likeness.
I think after talking about it more, I like it. Mm-hmm. And thinking about it more, I was kind of, again, lukewarm on it. But I mean, we haven't even touched on more than half the film, right? And we're running long here. So there's just so much to talk about. And there's so many topics of conversation. So I enjoyed it.
Mm. Maggie, let's get your final thoughts here, brother. I feel like I want to hear more from you. Speak.
I mean, yeah, sure. I will be seeing the sequel in theaters. I don't know what else to say. I guess my closing thoughts then would be, earlier I said that like I was going into this thinking it was going to be the next Star Wars, Lord of the Rings. I don't think that's true narratively, but every day since seeing the movie, I have not been able to get it out of my head. And I think in terms of speculation and building anticipation in between movies and as a franchise, I think it is the next Star Wars. It's just the story itself is not the next Lord of the Rings Star Wars. But yeah, I would say those are my closing thoughts. I'm certainly excited for the next one, and I will be seeing it.
Yeah, I think it was artistically significant lighting. I keep going back to the lighting and things like that, the different types of cuts they use. It's a smart man's film, smart woman's film, smart person's film. It's not like a silly blockbuster. And I personally think themes are there, but obviously we have some disagreement on that. One thing I will say is that they kind of knew that this film wasn't super action-packed, so they used the trailer. The thing I didn't like was they were using the climax of the trailer was actually just like a preview for the next film, which I kind of had an issue with, the face mat, when like his face opens up, Timothy Chalamet's face opens up, you see his face. They made it seem like that was going to be the climax of this film, but that's not going to happen, and maybe not happen, but I think it's clear it's going to happen in the next film. So when you clearly only set something up, I have problems with that. I mean, it was a good film, but I would say like 3.5 stars. It kind of reminds me a little bit of Batman versus Superman, a little. That's literally what. After I come on, Matt, I want to hear you laugh.
That's a great comparison.
No, it's not. It's better. Zack Snyder geeks. If someone.
Yeah, no, it is better, but it's in the same similar style, right?
It's very much.
I would like to hear Matt's.
Yeah, Matt was laughing. Come on, Matt. Speak it. Say what you trust.
I think I need you guys to clarify this comparison. I'm not seeing the comparison.
Because it was like a preview for the next film. It was like almost a trailer for the next film.
I was thinking in terms of how, not how it was shot.
The dream
sequences. Well, actually, yeah, how it was shot. The dream sequences, yeah. The dialogue.
Okay, I can see that. Yeah, all right.
It's not a fun movie, right? They're both not that fun.
Well, they're fun. They're more
fun. They're fun.
But they're not like dumb fun. I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
But yeah, I know, Matt. You don't like.
Well, I would say Dune less so than Batman vs Superman is less dumb fun than Batman vs Superman.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, I just was reminded. That's why I'm kind of lukewarm on this film. I thought it was gonna be like the best thing, and it wasn't. Which is fine though. We keep
hoping. So what? Hold on, I missed it. What'd you give it out of?
Like a 3.5. I'd give
3.5.
Just because.
Let's go around the table. Let's go out of 5.
I'd go 4 out of 5.
4 out of 5. Bill.
I'm going 4.5.
I'll go, that's a good take. I'll go 4.25 spice out of water.
Yeah, we ran a little bit over. So thanks everybody for coming on, Matt, Rob, and Bill. It was really a pleasure to have you guys on. We've been waiting so long to see this film and talk about this film as well. So it's been like a year, literally like a year and a half, basically, in the making, this podcast. So I want to thank you guys all for coming on. I really appreciate it. It was a pleasure. Sorry again for the audience. We're a little bit over, but there was a lot to talk about. I think we covered a lot, and we looked ahead to the next film, and I think that hopefully we gave you some analysis or thoughts that you're not just going to hear from everybody else.
Everyone read the book before the next one comes out.
I actually know what, I already like read spoilers. I didn't care. It's all right. I read Wikipedia.
Hold on. You read the spoilers already?
I mean, look, they gave some spoilers themselves, so you got to blame them. How about
yeah, the dream spoilers.
Yeah.
For sure.
They gave it away. But thanks, everybody, for listening. You can follow us at RMM_901, our letterbox.
Oh, yeah, quick plug here. You can follow me at rbastone on Twitter and at rob_bastone on Instagram. I'm also on Snap. You don't have to follow me on there, but follow me on those two platforms. A lot of also, hot takes coming.
Plug Matty G's Villanova review site. The Villanovan, right, Matty G? Check you out on that platform.
Sure.
Bill, you need to plug you on anything, Bill?
No, I'm in the dark. I'm off the grid.
Good stuff. That's where you want to be. So check out the letterbox, JABNYRIC. I got some flaming hot.
Yeah, the letterbox was really good. Keep on pushing the Venom review because that's a good read.
And movies. Anyway, whatever. Let's not think about it. Thanks, everybody, for coming on. Thank you for listening. We got an interview in 2 weeks' time, and I hope everyone enjoys the podcast. Thank you.